That it's been ever thus. Well, you know, I'm rather a freak in AA. As Jim said, I'm supposed to be the oldest man in AA. If there's anybody old, I don't know it. Because the thing is, all the men who preceded me were 10, 15, or 20 years older than I was. And time has taken its toll, and they're all gone. I happen to be the next birthday. If I live this long, I'll be 80 years old. You can see how old the rest of these birds would be. So they just didn't make it. So I was fortunate. I was only 35 years old when I arrived here. So they thought I was too young for this thing at the time. Why, I am a freak. I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. There was no AA when I arrived here. When I met my sponsor, Dr. Bob, he put me in Akron City Hospital, where I sobered up. And when I was in that hospital, the alcoholics who were in the Oxford movement that time, they were a minority, they came to visit me. And when I left the hospital that night, he took me to the meeting of the Oxford group at T. Henry and Clarissa Williams' home in Akron, Ohio. And this was known as the Oxford Movement at that time. And it stayed the Oxford Movement for 15 months, till up in May of 1939, when we split away from the Oxford group, the Cleveland contingent, and we started our own group. It was the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world, in Cleveland, at 39. So a lot of this stuff you hear about 1935, that is not exactly correct. There were some people around at that time, a few of them, but they were strictly Oxford group. And I want to tell you something just to give you a little light on this history of AA before I get into anything else, because there's so much confusion about it. The Oxford group was a religious fellowship, and it was a Protestant fellowship, and a Catholic did not belong or could not because his church did not permit him to. So there were no Catholics around when I arrived, and Doc told me to go back to Cleveland when I left the hospital and I should spend the rest of my life fixing drunks as an avocation. We didn't call them alcoholics. When they called me an alcoholic, I was being elevated. We called them rummies in those days, and I still do. And so I went back to Cleveland, and all my enthusiasm and my steam and my ignorance, I started tackling rummies on the street. And back in the 30s, there were plenty of them around because there was a deep depression on, and there were a lot of them wandering around, didn't even have any homes. So I'd walk up to some drunk on the street and tell him he should quit drinking. He should be like me. Well, you can imagine the reception I got from some of these people. I don't mind telling you, some of it was physical. But after 7 long months and having talked to hundreds and hundreds of assorted alcoholics, dipsomaniacs, rummies, drunks, or what have you, I finally nailed my first baby. They call them pigeons around here. We didn't call them pigeons. We call them baby. I'd rather call them rabbits than pigeons. I think it's more apropos. But anyway, I nailed my first fellow, and he happened to be Polish. And after that, people came in real fast. It took me 7 months to get my first one. See, this was a selling job. We had to sell this idea to people. So after that, there was an invasion of Irish. The Irish invaded us. And out of the first dozen people we had in this group, 7 of them were Catholics. I took them down to Akron to the Oxford group meetings, and they couldn't accept that. Their church would not permit it. So I went down to see my sponsor about it and tell him what we're up against. And he said, well, we're not keeping them out of the Oxford group. I said, no, you're not keeping them out, but their church keeps them out. It's all the same. They can't come. He says, well, that's their tough luck. I says, no, Doc, this don't have to be their tough luck. We now have a book. We wrote this book in the fall of 38, and it came out in February of 39. And this is May of 39 when I'm talking to my sponsor and telling him how he should run his business. And I said, no, we have this 12-step program now, and with the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love, anyone can live by that. And he says, well, you can't do that. I said, can't do what? He said, you can't break this thing up. I said, I'm not trying to break anything up. I'm trying to open it up so people can get in. He says, well, you can't do that. I says, well, we're going to do something. He says, like what? I says, you'll see. So I had another Irishman in the hospital in Akron. He was a lawyer, patent lawyer, Al Goldrick. You'll see his story in one of the later editions of the book. I think his story is called He Thought He Could Drink Like a Gentleman or something like that. But you'll see my name in that story, so you'll recognize it. He was down there all smoked up with formaldehyde in the hospital. I didn't talk to him. I went out to see his wife about using their home for a meeting place. We had no money for meeting halls or anything, and we had been accustomed to meeting in homes. So she was delighted with the idea. So here's what happened. Here's how AA started. I went down to Akron the next Wednesday night and made this statement. Said, this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are starting our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address. I shouldn't have done this. 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. I said this further, and this is not going to be known as an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. And further, I said, this is what caused the real riot. I said, only alcoholics and their families are welcome, nobody else. Well, being a minority in there, the Rummies, you can imagine what happened. All the rest of those people, they'd been so good to us and everything, and we're shutting them out like that, keeping them out of our society. Well, to say the least, the roof came off of T. Henry's house. Clarence, you can't do this. I said, it's done. You must come down and talk about it. I said, there's nothing to talk about. It's done. Well, if I thought that was a riot, you should see next Thursday night up at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. That whole group came up and descended upon us and tried to break our meeting up. And one guy was going to whip me. And as I said before, this is all done in pure Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. That was a series of riots that got us started, and we have been rioting ever since. We rioted to the extent that we have several thousand groups around the world now. You know, it's a wonderful thing. And I look back and look at some of these things that happened. I remember so distinctly one night looking at that group up at 2345 Stillman Road and saying to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful if we ever had as many as 35 members here? Yeah. It wasn't 2 years' time we had 35 groups in Cleveland. I'll figure that out. And now it's gone all over the world. If there isn't any place you can go that you don't find AA. In various stages of deterioration or otherwise, but it's there. So it's become an international situation, and you and I are part of this. You know, since I've been in this fellowship, I've spent an awful lot of time working with people, organizing groups, getting publicity, appearing before the TV, the radio, what have you. I'm not an anonymous creature, and anybody tries to tell me to keep quiet, they're talking to the wrong guy. Because if we'd have kept quiet like they talk about today, you wouldn't have an AA. Somebody had to go out and do something. So my anonymity is my own business. It's nobody else's. So if I want to tell people I belong to AA, that's my privilege, same as yours. And I tell them. And I've been around a good deal doing this, and I don't see where it's ever hurt anyone. And I will continue to do that till I can no longer get around. The reason is this. Over the years, I've discovered something. I've studied this thing of alcoholism. I have a thick book about this thick at home about the history of alcoholism. It was written back in the early 1800s, and it traces alcoholism back for several hundred years. And what all the efforts that were put forth in trying to modify the alcoholic's drinking pattern. And every one of them failed. And in going further, I found that alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. It really is. You can read about alcoholism in ancient history. You can read about it in mythology, and you can read about it in the Bible. There's some very good rummy stories in the Bible. Since this is Sunday, I think I'll tell you a couple of them. You don't have to go any further than the first chapter, the first book of the Bible, I should say, and you meet your first rummy. You meet our friend Noah. He was one of us. And here's the evidence. You know, the world got itself into a condition about the way it is today. Everything going downhill and everybody accepting the philosophy of it feels good, do it, you know. And the moral responsibility of people is just about gone to nothing. So God got fed up with all this situation and decided the only way he could ever correct it was just wipe the whole thing out and start all over again. But he needed some seed, so he had a plan. So he went to his friend Noah, and he says, Noah, he says, I want that you should do something for me. He says, yes, Father, anything, God. He says, I want that you should build a big boat, a big ark. And he gave him the dimensions of this. He said, I want you and your family to do this. And after it is completed, I want you to put two of every living creature in there and your family so we'll have some seed because I'm going to flood this world and start all over again. Okay, old Noah's right with him. So Noah and his family get out there sawing logs and cutting down trees and making a lot of racket and building this boat. And along comes the neighbors. They say, what are you doing, Noah? I'm building a boat. A boat? They're out in the middle of the desert? Old Noah's playing with a short deck. So they criticize the old boy, and they go on their way, and they shake their head for poor old Noah. But they kept this up for year after year, building this ark, and they finally got it completed. And they, sure enough, they loaded it up as God had ordained with all these animals and so forth. And they shut the door. And finally, those rains came. And it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And that old boat came up and started to float. People were pounding on that door. They wanted to get in. The ones that had laughed at old Noah, but they didn't get in. No one else got in. That boat floated around for a long time. And finally, it came to rest on Mount Ararat. The water receded. The land came up. And what was the first thing our friend Noah did? He ran out there, he planted a grape arbor, he raised some grapes, he made some wine, and got drunk. So that's the first rummy in history, recorded history. I like some of those stories in a good book about rummies. They're so good. I like the one about the prodigal son. This is a good rummy story. Here's these two boys. They're both Jews. To keep this in mind, they're Jewish. And their father has a big spread. He's a big farm. He's got cattle. He's got sheep. He's got goats. He's got no hogs. He's got everything else. And these two boys are working for their dad out on this big farm. And, of course, according to the way things were in the society then, when the dad dies, the boys come in to share the loot, you know. Well, this one kid, the older boy, he always worked. Oh boy, he was at it all the time. work and doing more than he should be doing. He was the Al-Anon kid. But the other kid, the young one, guess who? He was dissatisfied with all this stuff. And he didn't want to wait till some indefinite time when his father died. He wanted his loot right now. You know, did you ever hear that before? Just like yesterday. He wants it now so he can enjoy it while he's young. He doesn't want to wait till some indefinite time to get it, so he keeps bugging his father and bugging his father for his share of the loot. So finally his father can't take it anymore. He says, okay, take your share and be gone with it. So he gives this kid his share and away he goes. And what does it say in the good book? It says he went into a far country and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear of anything like that? He blew the whole bundle. It's gone. He's tapped out. And that isn't the worst of it. He's in a far country. He's a stranger. And a famine sets in. He can't get a job. He's about to starve. And he has to exist. And he's having a rough time. So what does this kid do? He finally got a job where he could eat. He got a job on a hog farm. Remember, this kid's a Jew. He's nursing a bunch of hogs. And does he eat what the hogs eat? Don't say that in the Bible. It says he ate of the husks of the hogs. He's eating what the hogs wouldn't eat and what they left over. I'd say this kid pretty well hit his bottom, wouldn't you? He did it. So finally he said something very important. It says there, he came to himself. He came to himself. This is what you and I had to do. We came to ourselves. He says, I starve. My father has much. He said, his servants eat well, and I starve. Then he said this. This is important, and we had to say the same thing. He says, I will arise and go to my father and tell him I'm unworthy. And I will be as a servant to him. We have to do the same thing. So that kid got off his duff, and he started that long journey, that long trek back home. He's beaten, whipped, sick, just washed out. And he had to go face the music. And he started for home. Did his father chew him out? Didn't say that. He says, it says in there, the father saw him coming afar off, and he ran to this boy, and he fell on his neck and kissed him. He said, my son who is dead is alive. Let's put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet, a cloak on his back. Let us have a party. Let's kill the fatted calf. Let us have a party. My son who is dead is alive. So they take this kid up to the house. And they're having a big blast. They're having a party, boy, music going and dancing. Everybody's eating. Meanwhile, that Al-Anon kid's still out there working. He's out there going at it. And he hears all this racket up at the house. And so a servant comes by. He says, hey, what's all that ruckus up at the house? He says, haven't you heard? He says, heard what? He says, your brother came home. He says, oi, that dirty no good. So he drops his tools, and then he went to the house and confronted his father. Now, this is a very human thing. He goes up to his dad. He says, father, he says, I have been a good son to you. I've always done more than you ever required of me. He says, and this no good brother of mine took his inheritance out and blew it on wine, women, and song. He comes back here, you have a party for him. He says, Dad, Papa, you never had a party for me. Eh? Well, his father had to get him straightened out. That's a great story of the forgiveness. Great story of the second chance, you know? That's a rummy story. That kid, boy, he was one of us. I don't have to explain that to you. Well, since it's Sunday, I'll tell you one more. I like that story of the Good Samaritan. Here is a rummy story, believe me. Here's this bird lying there on the side of the road. He's stripped naked. Everything's gone. And he's all beat up and he's about half dead, see? And he's lying there in the road, alongside the road. And along comes a priest. And he sees him lying there. And he looks at him. He's a man of the world. He knows what happened to this bird. He got drunk and he got rolled. I don't know if any of you ever got rolled, but this kid did. So he's lying there, and this priest sees him, and he says, "Look, the dirty, no-good bum. He got himself in that condition. Let him get himself out of it." You hear that yet today, you know. So he crossed on the other side and left the fellow in his misery. And along came a Levite, and he's a man of the world, and he sees that bird lying there. Same thing. He says, "Good enough for the drunken bum. He got himself in that shape. Let him get himself out of it." So he crosses across the street and leaves him there. And along came this Samaritan fella. This guy's a traveling salesman. I'll prove that to you. He's out there. This is the territory he's making. So he's coming along there, and he sees this bird lying there. And he's a rummy, too, this Samaritan. The Samaritans were not the chosen people around those days. But anyway, did he pass him by? No. He got down off of his form of conveyance. It certainly wasn't a Chevrolet. He's making probably a mule. And what did it say he did with this fellow? He ministered to him. He gave him a drink. He gave him that medicine he needed. And did he leave him lie there? No, siree. He picked him up and he put him on his form of conveyance and took him to the Holiday Inn. Well, he took him to an inn, it says, anyway. And here's how I know they're all rummies. This salesman takes this fellow to this Holiday Inn, and he says to the innkeeper, he says, "Here, take care of this fellow, and here is some money." You see, he gave the money to the innkeeper, not to the rummies. He says, "You take care of this bird, and if there be any more due, I will repay you on my next visit," which means he's a salesman making that territory. So you see, there's a first 12-step call on record. So that's the first 12-step call we have in print. So that's the way. So much for the Sunday school lesson. You know, when I came here, as I say, there was no AA at the time, and it was quite an adventure in the beginning of all this. And there's an awful lot of experiences and a lot of wonderful people I met, and a lot of things happened, and there's a lot of fears and phobias came up. But somehow or other, things worked out, and we had to go out and make contacts with social workers, with church people, with doctors, with hospitals, with dry out places, all kinds of things that we needed. And it was... this was something to do, really, we had to. And people there any of the men around there never squawked. You give them a bunch of names to go out and chase, they chase them down. The big thing that happened in Cleveland was I found this newspaper man out in a bunkhouse. His wife had him probated. Eldrick Davis was his name. And he'd been drunk, he'd been kicked off of most all the newspapers in northern Ohio. And she just had enough of him, and she had him probated and put away in this loony bin. And he was out there. And some fella called me about him, not an alcoholic either, some fella that knew him. And he told me about Elric, and he says, "There's a good man if we ever get him straightened out." So he and I went out to see Elric, and I took the AA book out and talked to him about getting straightened out. And boy, he was all for it. He was going to do anything to get out of that loony bin. So I left a book for him to read, and he wanted to get straightened out. So we had to go out and talk his wife into letting him out, which he did. This was quite a sales job, believe me, worse than talking to him. So she finally agreed to let him out. And when he came out, he wrote a series of articles that appeared in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And man alive, we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inquiries from those articles. Following those articles, another newspaper man wrote a 3 days on a history of alcoholism. Then some preacher that tried to fix me years before, very unsuccessfully. When I was sober a year, I went back to see this fellow. I thought I owed him something. And, you know, it shocked me. I was sober a year, and I went back, and he didn't even know me. That was quite a change, you know. He'd never seen me clean, never seen me sober, never seen me with civilian clothes on. I always had mission clothes on. So He didn't know me. And he got so excited, he wanted to me to bring some of the fellows up to his house that evening or the next evening or something, which I did. I took three of the boys up there, and he had some of the outstanding citizens in Cleveland there. He had Dr. Bishop of the Lakeside Hospital Unit. He had the mayor up there. He had two judges. He even had the county coroner up there. And they were listening to us, to these stories, till 2:30 in the morning. They'd never heard anything about. There never had been anything that a drunk had ever recovered. And here's some guys recovering. This was entirely new in history. Well, that preacher got so excited he preached a sermon on Sunday. And his sermon, every Sunday the Cleveland Plain Dealer used to, on Monday, they'd publish one of the sermons from someone on Sunday, and they put his sermon in the paper. And he preached on Mr. X and Alcoholics Anonymous. He took the story of my life. And that was the first pamphlet AA ever had. He had to put in pamphlet form. I just mention these things to show you how things start to work together and get a cohesion here. Well, when those articles come in from the Plain Dealer, those hundreds and hundreds of them, they all came to me, and I would hand so many to you on Monday morning, and you would give them to these fellas on Monday, and I'd tell them to report to me on Wednesday what they did with them, just like a sales manager. And they'd go out and do it. And they were anxious to do it. So all of those people got covered. The ones that were from out of state, I used to sit down at night and write correspondence courses in AA to people out here in Milwaukee and what have you, you know. This was a wonderful experience. When you look back on it, it's unbelievable that these things could happen, but they happened. I think this whole program has been, I know it has been, God-directed from the start. And, God uses the most impossible creatures to do his work. He picks people that nobody else would pick. And it's true. I often said if I were to pick somebody to do the job I did in AA in the beginning, I'd be the last guy I'd pick because I had no qualifications for it. But I did it. It wasn't that I'm so smart. I was just stupid. But it worked. And some of those people in the beginning that did things you wouldn't believe when you hear their stories. But I found out that alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. I found that out in my years of being around here. And I found this out also, that up to the time that we started AA here, the alcoholic only had two options. And this has been down through the centuries. Remember, there have been millions and millions and millions of alcoholics who stumbled across the face of this earth and have existed and died in alcoholism and in misery, and in many instances carried some of their friends and family down with them. This has been going on for centuries, really. And up to this time, the alcoholic only had two options. He could go crazy or die or both. About 40 years ago, when this program came into existence, the alcoholic got a third option. He can still go crazy, he can still die, but now he can get well. And this was never in history before. This just gives us something to think about, and something to realize, and something to be so thankful for. And it gives us a responsibility. Now, why do people, after all these centuries of this misery, why do they walk into this group here, this meeting, or this bunch, or this society of ours, and bingo, after all this tragedy they're having in their life, they turn around and start flying straight. Why? Why? Well, why didn't this happen before? I really believe that one day God looked down on these rummies and said, I got to do something with those birds. So this is the way this thing started. Well, anyway, we have a plan, and we have a program. I hear all kinds of black about my program and his program or her program. I don't know what they're talking about. To me, there's only one program. That's our program. Don't tell me about your program or his program or her program. This is our program, and there's only one program. And by God's grace, we have this program, and due to this program, people now get well. Anybody can get well that comes in here if he's qualified. Now, what's the qualification? I don't believe a lot of this garbage that I hear about the qualification is just to stop drinking. Stop drinking what? Milk? That's all hogwash. Qualification for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is this. You must be an alcoholic who wants to quit booze and really means it. Really means it. A lot of people come, they're kidding themselves and kidding everybody else. They just come in here for a ride or to get out of some immediate problem they're into. But I have a qualification myself. I don't work with new people anymore. I don't have the chance or the time because I get new people, I turn them over to other people that need that exercise. I don't need that anymore. I work with people who've been around AA, around it, drunk or sober, for months or years, some of them many years. And they hear, some of them are awful miserable. They hear about this freak down in Castleberry, Florida, that has some way of fixing drunks in 2 days, taking them through the steps, and they never drink anymore, and everything changes. So some of them get curious, and some of them mean business. A lot of them do. And they call me. I don't get anybody from my own home, Ballywick. A prophet is without honor in his own home, you know. Yeah, you go 50 miles away, I'm an authority at home. I'm a bum. But this is always the way it is. So they call from all over, and they want to come down and get fixed. We call it fixing. And they come, and here's my qualification. And the person comes, man or woman, girl or boy, whatever. First of all, they have to be an alcoholic. They have to know it, I have to know it, and they have to admit it. That's first. Bingo. Number one. The second thing I want to know from them after I've assured that they're alcoholic, and they know it, and they admit it, and I know it, I ask you, what do you want to do about it?
Well, I want to quit. Well, you do, huh? A lot of people quit if I'll quit for them.
They don't like that too much, too well. So the third question I ask them, this is the important one. And I have to get the right answer to this question or I don't have anything for this bird. I say, what are you willing to do to quit drinking forever? I don't talk about 24 hours or 24 years or whatever. Forever. Brother, that's a long time. Especially for some dodo that's never made a week in his life. Forever. You get some funny answers sometimes to that one. But I keep coming back till I get the answer that I have to have. And when he or she tells me they're willing to do anything, then I've got somebody to work with. If they don't tell me that, I've got nothing to work with. See, they came to see me to get what I have. I don't want what they have. They can have what they have. But they came to get what I have. And if they're going to get what I have, they'll take it on my terms. And my terms are very distinct. I don't brook any compromise. I can't afford that. They didn't compromise with me when I started out, and I've got over 44 years of sobriety to back it up. And I've got a lot of people running around this world with many, 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 many years of sobriety to back it up. So I don't compromise. This is an absolute program. So when they tell me that they're willing to go to any lengths, now I didn't make that up. That's in the fifth chapter. You hear it read at most meetings. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Eh? That's where I get that. It's out of the program. I didn't invent that. So it's simple. So if they're not willing to do that, they can go home. If they are, they tell me they are, then I have the privilege of presenting this program in the way I know it, and the way I believe it, and the way that it'll be successful to them. The first time they start to back up, and I start telling them something they're going to have to do, nobody likes to be told anything they like to have to do. They don't like this kind of bit. That isn't my problem, that's their problem. They come here to get well. And I've got medicine for them. And they're going to take this medicine, or don't bother me. because I only have so much time, so much effort, so much interest. I'm just not going to bother monkeying with people trying to play games. But when a person comes to me, I assume he's not playing games. So he's going to take it the way I give it to him. So my 12-step program is what I present to him. The 12-step program is very simple. But people can screw it up. An alcoholic can screw up a two-car funeral. I mean, what they do to this program, it's pitiful. And so simple. There are 200 well-chosen words in this program, and any kid out of the second grade can pronounce any word in it and understand it. There's no five-syllable words in this program. But there's four phases to our program. The first phase of our program is the first step, and that's the phase of admission. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. You know the problem with that first step? People never hear the second part of that. They hear the first part, and they get yammering about drinking and alcohol for the rest of their life. For year after year, you're yapping about alcohol and how much they drink. I didn't come here to learn how to drink. I came here to learn how to quit. Everybody knows how to drink. Nobody has to teach anybody here how to drink. But they don't hear that second part. That second part says that our lives had become unmanageable. That is the most important part of that step. The alcoholism is just the key that brings you, opens the door so you can get in here. But getting our life manageable, that's what's important. And the whole rest of that program has to do with that. You don't find the word alcohol anymore in those 200 steps. The first step, it says alcohol. You don't hear it a bit. You never mention after that in this program. Not a bit about alcohol or alcohol. It's an awful lot said there about getting our life straightened out. So the first phase is admission that we're out of order. And we want to get orderly. So the second through the seventh step is submission. We admission, now submission. We resubmit our will and our lives to the care of God. Starts right off in that second step. It says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I came to believe it. It doesn't say I believed that when I arrived here. Well, how did I come to believe it? Those fellas told me something happened to them and it would happen to me if I take it. I wanted to get well. So I was willing to do anything they told me. So that's how I came to believe. The influence and the example of the men who preceded me. There were 14 men preceded me. And they told me their stories. They were all older than I was, as I mentioned before. Boy, they impressed me. I wanted what they had. I was willing to do anything they told me. I had no choice. I was without everything. So I came to believe because they told me they believed and it would help me if I did. So, okay, I believe. You know what Doc did to me in the hospital? Let me tell you how this thing was presented to me in the hospital. Every day those men came in to see me. They told me their stories. And then after they concluded their story, they all told me one thing. They said they had the answer to my drinking problem, and on that note, they left. Goodbye. They didn't tell me what the answer was. They went. So I'm lying in that bed wondering what's going to happen to me. I was looking for an operation, see? My sponsor was a doctor, and he was a rectal surgeon. I might say I was pretty much ready for anything. So the last day I'm in the hospital, after all these men had talked to me, Doc came in as usual. Every afternoon he'd come in, sit on the foot of my bed and look at me, and I was scared to death of this guy. Really I was. Doc, as any of you knew him, was a tall, lanky, 6'4" guy with real thin, and he had fingers on him this long, which I think were an asset to him. And he used to poke me in the chest with his finger. I hate a guy that pokes me when he's talking to me. It's almost as bad as those guys that put their nose up against you when they're talking to you. Well, anyway, he looks at me, he says, "Well, young fella," he called me young fella. He always called me young fella till he was mad at me. When he called me Clarence, I know I'm in trouble. But when I'm young fella, I'm in good stead with him. He said, "Young fella, what do you think of all this by now?" I said, "Well, Doc, I think this is wonderful. All these guys coming in, they don't know me from a load of hay. They tell me the stories of their life and what happened to them through booze. But I'm puzzled about one thing." He says, "And what's that?" I says, "Well, they all tell me that they have the answer to my drinking problem, and then they go. They don't tell me. What are you going to do to me? What comes now?" He says, see, he threw me a real curve now. He says, "Well, young fella, we don't know about you. You're pretty young, and we don't know if you've had enough yet. Here I'm coming up off the bum. I weigh 130 pounds. I have no more home than a rabbit. I've got one brown shoe and one black one. I think someone else had a pair like that somewhere." But there I am. I'm really the Beau Brummel. And he says, "I don't know if you're ready yet." He says, "We haven't had any luck with these young fellas. They're all screwballs." Well, I'm not one to argue that with them. So I guess I finally convinced him I was ready. He says, "All right, young fellow, I'll give you the answer to this." So he points that big finger at me, and this is something I never expected to hear. He says, "Young fellow, do you believe in God?" Holy smokes, that's the last thing I expected out of a doctor. I'm looking for that operation. So I have to get around this, you know. I can't go on with this deal. So the best I can come up with out of this blubber is, well, what does that have to do with it? You know, I thought that was pretty bright. He says, "Young fella, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God?" Now I'm getting worried. This guy's not going to fix me unless I go along with him. But I'm not wanting to go along with this deal. So he emphasizes, "Do you or do you not believe in God?" Well, the next best thing I can come up with is, "Well, I guess I do." He says, "There's no guessing about it, you do or you don't."
Turn the tape.
I'm in trouble. See? So I'm going to have to go ahead now. So he asked me again. I says, finally, I said, "Yes, I do." He says, "That's fine, young fellow. Now we can get someplace." He says, "Get down out of that bed." I said, "For water." He says, "You're going to pray." I said, "Who's going to pray?" He said, "You're going to pray." I said, "I don't know anything about praying." He said, "I don't suppose you do, but you get down there just the same, and I'll pray, and you can repeat after me. That'll do for this time." So he hauls me down out of that nice warm nest on that cold concrete floor in his shorty nightgown. And boy, I am getting scared again. And he put his hand on my head, and he prayed. And I repeated after him. I don't remember what it was, but I have a pretty good idea what he said. But I do remember he's shaking hands with me after the conclusion of that prayer. And he said, "You're going to be all right, young fellow." And he took me to a meeting that night of the Oxford Movement. That's how I was introduced to this spiritual foundation of AA. Now, why people squawk about this, all this stuff, is beyond me. They come here to get well, and then they want to do it on their terms. It's ridiculous. It's silly. So, that's how I started. Well, now I do this. I found out about this program. It has these different phases, the second through seventh step. Second step says that we came to believe that God could restore me to sanity. Third step says we made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's quite a decision. Believe me, for somebody that's been running away from him for so long. The fourth step, most people fail in AA in two places. First of all, they screw up step number one. They have to do that. Then they get step three and step four all mixed up. Step three, it says, "I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God." So they start to figure out who God is. And some of them, they say he's an electric light bulb. Somebody said he's a chair. Somebody said he's a group. Somebody said he's something else. I'd hate like the devil to trust my everlasting soul to a light bulb or a chair or a table or an AA group either. That's about it. Believe me. So We have to define who this God is, you know? And it's the sooner we do this with a new person, the better off everyone is. Because he has to make a decision to turn his will and his life over to the care of this character. When I used to be, I suppose, like a lot of people. To me, God was some old man sitting up in way up here with a long, light, white gown and a long, white beard writing dirty things in a book about me. See? Well, that was my conception. I had to get that changed. To turn my will and life over to a creature like that, you're not about to do that unless you hurt real badly. So alcoholics will never do any of this till they hurt. You know, we don't do this by reasoning. An alcoholic never thinks. The people that bring those think signs, you ought to take those think signs down. You got them in here? No, no, you don't. You're lucky. You don't have any think signs. Don't ever put that up. It's an insult to an alcoholic. We don't think, we emote. No alcoholic ever does anything until he hurts. If you hurt bad enough, take the program. If you don't, forget it. You'll make up your own program. That's exactly the way it goes. So, we made a decision to turn our will and life over to this care of God. That is quite a decision. Then the next step, that's one they fail on because they try to put everything in there but God himself. The light bulb and the chair and all this garbage. Well, the fourth step, this one they really get screwed up on, especially girls. These people come to our house, men and women, and it never fails when some gal comes to get taken through these steps in 2 days. She brings a sheaf of papers this thick with all the garbage written on there that she ever did in her life. I don't know how the poor souls remember all this stuff. I operated so much in blackouts, I never knew where I was yesterday, let alone what happened 9 months or 9 years ago like they have. But they have it all written down there, all the dirty, goofy stuff and all the bedhugs crawling and all the stuff they've ever done. And I know what's in there. I don't have to read it. So the poor dears hand me this for their fourth step, and I turn around and drop it in the wastebasket. They faint. Well, I know, that isn't what the fourth step calls for. It's not the detail. It isn't the details of your transgressions. It's what caused you to cause these. What made you put you together and made you this way. The weaknesses in our character, and there's 20 questions that I ask people on that fourth step. I write them down on a piece of paper, and I ask individually each question. They tell me whether they have it or not. So I go on. It's a bus. It has to do with self-pity, self-justification, and hate, and resentments, and all that. But there's 20 of them. So usually people wind up with 10 or 12. That they tell me they have. Well, that's what I call the fourth step. They have to find out what's causing them to be the boobs that they are. So these are the things that cause us to be anything but what we should be on the straight and narrow. So we have to get rid of those different things, these resentments, these hates, and these gossiping and all this sort of thing. So it says there, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. That's the moral inventory. It's not the details, because the next step tells you it isn't. It says we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, not the wrongs themselves. I'm not interested in the wrongs. I know what they've all done. They've all done the same thing, as much as they can get away with. So admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being. It tells me in a good book where two or three are gathered together in my name, there will I be also. So there's the three of us there, see? All right, it says, then it says the next step, this is good. We were entirely ready. Entirely ready for what? To remove these? No, we can't remove these. To have God remove all these defects of character. All of them. Can you imagine that? There's some defects of character I'd like to keep. They're fun things. But the program don't give me that option. It's all or nothing at all. I'm a rummy. I never do anything halfway. You're a rummy. You don't do anything halfway. That's whole hog or nothing. And we have to do the same thing when we recover. But people just don't seem to want to do that. Because this is all or nothing at all, this program. We're entirely ready to have God remove them. I can't remove them. He's going to remove them. If I could have removed him, I'd have done it long ago. So would you. But you can't. Tells you that in the first step. You admit it, you're powerless. Your life's unmanageable. You can't do it. So you have to hire a manager. You hire the manager in step three. So you have to depend on this manager to do your work for you that you can't do yourself. How about that? That's simple, isn't it? So the seventh step says, I humbly asked him to remove these shortcomings. When you go through the steps with me, you're on your knees in step three, and you're on your knees in step seven. You do it. And believe me, that step seven, when they're down there, some of these biggest people just crack up. They go all apart. They come apart. Some of them do, really. So I kind of expect it sometimes. They just dissolve. Something happens to them. After seven steps, I tell every person I ever take through, you are the cleanest person in the world right now. The cleanest person, because he's asked forgiveness for everything he's ever done. And he's forgiven. The Lord will forgive you everything if you ask him and you believe he'll answer you. They're gone. In the seventh step, all that stuff's gone. And I say, you are the cleanest person in the world. I said, you haven't had a chance to do anything else yet. I said, but you'll make mistakes. That's why we put rubbers on lead pencils. People will make mistakes. But we have a provision in this program to take care of mistakes. You see? We have to go and do our restitution in eighth and ninth. After seven steps, I send them back to their room or wherever they are and tell them to write down the names of every person in the world they owe any apologies to, living or dead. And anybody they owe money to, anybody they've gypped, anybody they stole from, whatever, they owe any restitution. Write it down on a paper and bring it to me in the morning. And they bring me this list of stuff in the morning. And some of them are really rough, believe me. And I tell them what to do in every instance. And they take care of it. So the restitution's taken care of. It's very bad. It could be very bad for a new person to go out and try to make restitution by himself, because he can create carnage out there, trying to get himself his own skirts clean at the expense of someone else. So it needs someone there to help him. So I tell him what to do. So obviously, you can't make amends to every person, because a lot of people are not here. They're not in your orbit. They're dead or they're gone. You don't know where they are. Well, what do we do in that case? We ask our manager to take care of it. Isn't that simple? What are you going to manage for? Let him handle it. What you can't handle, you let him handle. So you ask him, he takes care of that. So forget it. So after nine steps, we're new people. We're new people. Now, after taking nine steps, hear that. Get that in your head. After taking these nine steps, not reading them, not listening to them, doing them, forget them. You don't have to mess with them anymore. You're done. See how a simple program I have? I don't need to worry about 12 steps. I live on three steps now, because those other nine steps have cleaned me up. I'm a new person. Now I live on the last three. Step 10 is going to take care of me. It says in there, it's another inventory step. It has nothing to do with step 4, whatever. People get those two steps screwed up. Step 4 and step 10. Step 4 says a moral inventory. It doesn't say that down there. It says we continue to take personal inventory. And then also it says something else in that step. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Boy, oh boy, that's something for Robbie to do, admit he's wrong. Not me. No, that personal inventory has to do with our daily activity, how we live today. I have to have a very simple program. I'm not smart enough to go through all these programs that some of these monkeys are tied up with, all these psychiatrists and psychologists and yogi men or what have you. I can't handle this stuff. I have to have something simple. I'm too stupid. So my program is very simple. Here's what I do with my 10th step. At night, my day is through. I'm all done. I'm in bed. It's my prayer time. Grace has hers, I have mine, we have ours together. And then I'm there alone with my thoughts. And I think about my day. Where have I been? What has transpired? Who did I meet? What's happened? Did I do anything worthwhile today? If so, I give myself a pat on the back. Oh boy, you get a star for that one. On the other hand, maybe I hurt you, and I owe you an apology. Okay? I can't wait. That has to be the first priority tomorrow. I got to come and call you or see you and tell you I'm sorry that I did this, and will you forgive me? This is very important. It says in that step, it says promptly. Not at my convenience, it's promptly. It's now. Why now? We're the greatest people in the world for putting things off. And it's very easy to do that. And that's not right. We got to keep things straight day by day. I don't know how many people put that discipline on themselves, but I do. I do. And it's worked wonders for me. If it can work for a stupid guy like me, it can work for anybody. Believe me, it does work. Now, 11th step. It tells us we're seeking something. The good book tells me, you seek and you shall find. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. Praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. Boy, there are a lot of words. Because I'm seeking something through prayer and meditation. Well, what is prayer and what's meditation? To me, prayer is talking to my manager and meditation is listening to him. I have found out over the years that the good Lord gave me two ears and one mouth. That ought to suggest something to us. So I'm seeking through talking to him and listening to him. If I don't listen, I'm not going to get the orders. See? What am I looking for? I want to establish I want to improve my conscious contact with him. What does that mean? That means I want to feel that he's right here. He isn't way out in the blue yonder where he's inaccessible. He's right here where I can talk to him, listen to him, get answers from him. So I have to keep selling myself that idea all the time. And boy, it pays dividends. Try it. You'll be very much surprised if you haven't been doing it. It says, I sought through prayer and meditation, talk to him, listen to improve my conscience. Now it tells me what I'm praying for. Walk into a group meeting sometime, an AA meeting, and ask some people what they pray for.
I pray to stay sober.
Oh, you nitwits, if you ever go through this, don't ever do that. You don't pray for sobriety. You got sobriety. Thank him for it. You got other things to pray for. You got to pray for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. It says only that you pray for. Hey? You might do that in different ways. Sure, you're going to pray for people. Be careful what you pray for. You might get it. Like the guy, the fella didn't like this other guy. There's a guy back in our town, he is a real slob. And somebody said, I'm going to pray for that guy that he goes to heaven. He dies and goes to heaven tonight. That isn't quite the way to do things, but that's the way he felt. All right, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of the will for us and the power to carry it out. I found out he'll never put anything on me that he won't give me the power to execute. Always do that. You'll always get the power to do it. And if you listen, believe me, he's going to put you in places you never thought you were going to be. I can attest to that, believe me. Then the 12th step tells us what happened because we did these things. They are here about 12 stepping. What do they think of 12 stepping? They think it's running after some clown all the time that's drunk. That's not 12 stepping. Doesn't say anything about chasing after these drugs. It has 12 steps. It says, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. That's what we're looking for, is a spiritual experience. Once we get that, then we can do something. Then it says, we tried to carry this message, not the rummy, we carried the message to other alcoholics. And get that, it says alcoholics. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not Dopes Anonymous. This is not Fatso Anonymous. This is not Mad Gamblers Anonymous. It's not Nose Pickers Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that on the cover of the book. And that's what we're interested in. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. What principles? Somebody says, there's 12 principles. I heard some guy in a club say that yesterday. Isn't it with 12 principles? Where do you find that? It's principles of love and service. That's what our principles are. It's very simple. So we're going to practice that in all of our affairs, not only with one another here, not only with our family, but with the people we work with, the people we don't like, too. Especially. There's an awful bunch of doughheads in this world we don't like. But we have to live with them. We have to put up with them. And we have to pray for them. Pray that they something happens to them. Not tonight. So there's a simple program. 200 words. And some of the funniest things we hear about this program and how you get a bunch of rummies and screw things up. They get this program coming and going, believe me. And it's so simple, but people don't want to let go. Alcoholics are different than people. Get this. They're different than people. We are not like these people out there. We're not like those birds at all. We are a breed of cats all our own. And I don't think there's over 8 or 9%, perhaps, maybe 8% or less, of the population who can become alcoholics. Really. There's a big difference between drunks and alcoholics. Every alcoholic's a drunk, but every drunk's not an alcoholic. I drank with a lot of drunks that don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. You have to have something on a stick to be an alcoholic. Your characteristics are different than those people out there. Those people out there are thinkers. They go in, they contemplate their navel about everything. Alcoholics don't think about anything. They act, they do something. You can bet on that, something's going to happen. Thinking is not our that's not us. We act. The alcoholic has different characteristics than those people out there. I've never met an alcoholic, a real alcoholic in my life. There was not a high-strung individual. I never met one that wasn't, he's a very sensitive soul. He's always going around looking for someone to hurt his feelings. He's the biggest liar that ever wore shoes. He's quick. He don't think deep. He's not a deep thinker. He'll never pose for the statue of Rodin's thinker. But he acts. He'll do something. He is a man or a woman of action. And his mental processes work different than people. He's always conniving. He's always figuring something out. There's some deal going on here or going on there. He got 14 irons in the fire all the time. Yeah, he's something else. He's a very lonely person. He'd be lonely in a crowd. He really can. You see him walk into AA groups meetings. You see him walk into these meetings and they sit in that back row. There's 100 people in the meeting and the guy's lonesome. They'll come in here and sit around. You've got all this opportunity for fellowship here. And some of these guys and gals are lonesome as all get out. They really are. They're lonely people. And they have great potential. They have a terrific imagination. Alcoholics have a terrific imagination. They should all write books. And they have ingenuity. There's no stopping a rummy. A rummy can operate on 30% of his efficiency and beat the socks off of those earthlings out there. They're operating on 80%. Any day in the week, they'll do it. I know, I did it myself. I remember that last job I had. My God, I worked for a bank and they made an officer out of me and everything. And I just got fired one outfit I worked for 7 years. They transferred me, they gave me a promotion, I was running an office for them in Southern Ohio. They fired me for being drunk. I came back to Cleveland and by a fellow that originally hired me in the finance business was on the board of directors of that bank. And they had gone into the finance business and they were ready to take an awful bath financially. They were crying the blues in their directors meeting. And he said to them, he says, "Hey, I know the guy that can clean us out of this mess. I know the best finance man in the world." He's talking about me, if you can imagine this. I just got fired. But he didn't tell him that I got fired. He says, "I think he's available." So they send that man down. So I went down there and all the officers, they had a conclave and hired me to work. And I had to set up a department in that bank and get them. And I did. I worked for that office. Now remember, I was drunk when they interviewed me. I went to the notary. I was never sober. I was not, you know, there's two kind of drinkers. There's the periodic and there's the chronic. I was not a periodic. I never suffered like those people did. I was drunk all the time. But people didn't even know it. This is my normal way. I wasn't falling down drunk all the time, but I was always under the influence. So they hired me, and boy, they were in a panic, and they hired me. And I went to work for that outfit, and they made me a junior officer, if you can imagine this. And that, of course, didn't make a big hit with a lot of those old Irishers working in that bank. They'd been there for 20 years. What's that guy getting that for, you know? Well, anyway, I worked for there 3.5 years. I cleaned up that mess and saved them all that money, did them a wonderful job, and I was never, as I stand here, I was never sober one night in that 3.5 years. I'd go in there every morning stinking them out with that failed booze of mine. And I did them a wonderful job. Finally, they had to let me go because I was forgetting things. And they didn't know what I was doing there, but I was delivering. My desk was piled like this with stuff. They didn't know what was on that desk. I knew. When I wanted something, I knew right where to pull it out. And I never told this help of mine too much, any one of them too much. But they didn't know either. This is the way to rob me, you'll do. I'll tell you something. The day came and I had to leave, and I was supposed to go down to the president's office and get my last checks. And I went down there, and he wasn't in his office. I waited a long time. I'll never forget this. Finally, he came in, and I know now. I think I know why he made me wait all that time. But he wanted to give me the last hurrah and give me the last boot in the britches, you know. So he finally told me what an opportunity I blew, what I could have become in that bank. You know all that old stuff they give you. You know you're so great. And then finally he gave me my checks and I went upstairs to my office. And what do you think was up there? I had 2 great big desks there and they're full of presents. They're having a going away party for me. I'm getting fired. Nobody but a rummy can do this. Yeah. And fire me and they're having a, and I stood there like a damn fool and bald, you know. And away I went. I took my goodies in a basket and away I went home with them. I never saw any of those people again until 1942 when I landed in the Army down at Fort Knox. I ran into 2 of these guys who used to work for me. What a reunion. We had our pictures taken in those tanks and sent them up to the bank, showing where we were winning the war all by ourselves, the 3 of us. Oh, it was something. But this is what I did. It's what happened. And I cleaned them up. You know what happened to them? They had to hire 13 people when they fired me. 13 people. They had to put a whole new system in because they didn't know my system. This is a rummy. Well, so much for that. I think I see the boss looking at his watch over here. Do we have to? Is it rent up or what?
He just wants you to know it's out of hock.
It's out of hock. That's the first thing a rummy does is get a watch. He's to run down to Uncle Phil's to look in the window to see if they want his watch, everybody. Oh, boy. Well, you know, it's wonderful talking to you folks. It's wonderful being here. And you're a real bunch, and you're going to have a great time here, I know that. And I hope you have a good riot with the other bunch of split away. A good, successful riot. You know, that's the A. But keep this program simple like I do. Have fun. Enjoy life. Don't be worried about anything. You put your trust in your new manager and ask him for direction, and you get it, and everything comes along. And it just happens. I've seen this all my life since I've been dry. You know, when I came in this is 1938, if you remember, that was a bad, bad depression. There's not too many people here remember that, but any of you people with gray hair can remember that those depression in the 30s. A lot of you people weren't born then. But it was fierce. And I recall very few rummies had cars. The ones that did didn't have running boards. they were driving junkers. You know what happened to me when I came in here? I couldn't go back in the banking and finance business because I was more or less blackballed. And I don't think I could have handled it anyway. And so I had to do something, So I went to work selling automobiles. Me, I don't have 5 cents in my pocket, and I'm driving not one new car, I have two. I have a new Ford and a new Mercury for demonstrators. And they're in my name, if you can imagine this. And these other poor stops driving these junkers or hooking rides or other ones with junkers or something like that. And I'm driving around two brand new cars. I'm hauling drunks around in them all the time. This is rummies. We do these things, you know. Well, anyway, as I say before, it's wonderful talking to you. And best of everything to you. I could talk here all day. All night, and I guess you know it too. But, so start us off now. And I hope you all come to Florida sometime and visit us, and you'll find that AA is pretty much the same everywhere you go. You have people who believe in it, and you have people who experiment with it, and you have people that just flaunt it. But get on the ball, any of you who are not on the ball. Get on the stick. It's simple, it's easy. And don't make it tough on yourself. I try to take, that easy does it. I believe that. I really do. So that's why I have an easy program. I live on 3 steps, but I've taken those other 9. See? That's the secret. Well, thank you very much for being a very attentive audience and listener. Thank you, and best to you.